Rents are climbing, making life in South Florida a lot harder to enjoy. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Rents across the country are rising, but it's worse in South Florida. Landlords are trying to make up for what was lost in the pandemic. But how long can rents go up, and what are people giving up in order to stay in their neighborhoods? Share your story with us. What is your experience like hunting for a rental? Email us, sundial at WLRNnews.org. Also,
there's actually an interesting story about Fidel Castro and Queen Conks.
Seashells are beautiful and some people collect them, but they can tell us a lot about the environment. We'll hear Katie Munoz's conversation with author Cynthia Barnett about the important side of seashells. All of that today on Sundial after the news. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thank you so much for joining us. If you're out looking for an apartment or a house to rent, you've probably noticed that rental prices have, and pun intended, gone through the roof. South Florida is the worst in the country, according to a recent Bloomberg survey. Our metro area saw single-family rentals increase by 25% year over year in September. A big part of this, of course, is because of low inventory. Also, landlords are making up for what was lost during the pandemic. But how high can they raise rents? And how long can this continue? We heard from one of our listeners, Janet in Glenvar Heights. She says, "We've had to cut back on outings and entertainment because of the rising cost of living in South Florida. It's been even more challenging than before the pandemic." We want to hear from you. Are you out there right now looking for a place to rent? What are you finding? Or maybe you just found out that your landlord's going to raise rents and by a lot. What are you going to do? Text in now, 786-677-0767. Again, that's 786-677-0767. You can always email us, sundial at WLRNnews.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. Joining us now is Amber Randall, reporter for the South Florida Sun Sentinel. Amber, great to have you.
Thanks for having me.
And also joining us, Ken Johnson, Associate Dean of Graduate Programs at the College of Business at Florida Atlantic University. Ken, great to have you back.
Glad to be here.
And Daniela Pierre, she's the president of the Miami-Dade branch of the NAACP and a housing advocate. Daniela, also great to have you back.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
Daniela, I wanted to start with you because, you know, looking at these numbers and looking at what's been going on, I mean, look, you've been working in the housing advocacy space for over 5 years. We've seen rents go up, but this is different. Is it just the pandemic?
Thanks for the question. I think it's a number of reasons of what's steadily contributing to our affordable housing crisis. And one of those things I will say would be the lack of increase of wages. You know, while rent has increased significantly, based on recent studies, the median U.S. salary has only increased about 3 to 5%. So then the question becomes, rent is outpacing the wages across the board in rental markets as well as in home ownership markets. In this pandemic, while so many people either were laid off or lost their job because of the lack of childcare affordability, it's really presenting an additional strain. We've already had challenges within affordable housing for many, many years. But I would say this is not only different, but it's really a time that we need to get some solutions to move us forward.
Ken, I mean, one of the things I've noticed about this is, I mean, yeah, we've been talking about this on the program for years, is that, you know, the issue of affordable housing in South Florida has been a challenge. But now I'm seeing people on the other end of the scale, economically, even they're challenged. Rents are going up everywhere by a lot. And so even people who have money to afford it, it's tightening their wallets a bit.
So the main driver of rents and home prices in general in Southeast Florida is simply we are in a severe shortage of units either to rent or to own. And Southeast Florida, from Miami up through West Palm, is incredibly popular. We're expecting roughly a 14% population increase in the next 10 years in Palm Beach County, and roughly 9% increase in population in Miami-Dade, with Broward falling in the middle of that. And so we have this huge influx of people, and we're not building enough units. This is a reflection of the fact that, yes, the wages are growing up slow, or wages are going up slowly, but what's driving rents up is the fact that there's just not enough units.
Did I hear you say it right? 14%?
14% expected population growth in Palm Beach County in the next 10 years.
All right. So, I mean, look, and again, I'm only going by the eye test. I've been watching a lot of buildings go up, Ken. I've been watching a lot of towers go up. Miami, we had the joke that our city bird is the construction crane. What? So you're telling me we're not keeping up with the demand?
We are not keeping up with demand, and we had these same birds in 2005 and 6 when we had more supply than demand. This time around, it is different. The supply is not enough to keep up with the demand at this point in time.
And just to make sure,
you got to remember that we spent 10 years not building enough units.
And the pandemic, what role has that played, though?
From the pandemic standpoint, there's money that's been infused into the economy, and people are looking to either relocate or repurpose where they live. So some of this, very much of this, is being driven by pandemic-related activities or issues. But primarily, this is a shortage that has been 10 years in the making, and it's not going to go away in the next year or so.
Amber, you know, you're reporting really fascinating on this, because you looked at people, and in part, you looked at what people have had to change in their lives to be able to adapt to this new world. But did anything surprise you in your reporting as you talked to folks about what they were experiencing as they were trying to find a rental?
I would say the most surprising thing I found was how, I guess, unprepared and how shocking these rental increases were. I mean, renters were getting their rent renewals and they were seeing increases of $300, $400, and they had never even heard of such an astronomical rent increase. And there was really nothing they could do because rents were skyrocketing everywhere. And to even try to move somewhere else, they were facing the same increase, plus the cost of moving and coming up with a security deposit. And a lot of people found themselves stuck in their situation and scrambling to readjust their lives to an increase they never really saw coming.
Yeah. Who were some of the folks you were talking to?
I talked to your everyday person. I talked to teachers. I talked to people in the service industry. I talked to people who work in technology. And the problem was the same for everyone. They didn't know how to compensate for these rental increases, and they were having to really readjust their lives on the fly to make sure that they could keep a roof over their heads.
And yeah, as you mentioned, $300, $400, $500 increases. We've been seeing some in some places, and again, throughout South Florida, from Palm Beach County all the way down to the Keys, going up hundreds of dollars, even in some places over $1,000. Again, talking about rising rents, this is not just a South Florida issue. This is across the country, but South Florida, probably one of the worst places. And we want to hear from you. If you're out there searching for a rental, or you just got that notice from the landlord, your rent's going up and by a lot. What's going on with you? What is it doing to you in your life? Are you thinking about leaving the area, or do you have to give up on some stuff because the cost of living? Text us 786-677-0767 or email us sundial@wlrnnews.org. We've been hearing from folks all across the board. Here's a listener, wanted to stay anonymous, but in Miami, says, I've been looking for an apartment for my elderly disabled mother. Her apartment is in dire need of renovations, yet the rent went up $300 since the pandemic started. I was shocked to hear about waiting lists and people from New York City and California paying up to 6 months up front to cut in line. Moving had never been this difficult. It's not skyrocketing rent, it's gentrification. Can legally in Florida, how much can they raise rents? How much can a landlord raise my rent?
Well, this is whatever the market will bear. There is no restriction. There's no pricing restriction on rents. Usury laws and things like that disappeared years ago in the United States. So there's no upper bound to this. It's being driven by shortages, and we're going to see horrific stories like this until we can build enough units for both, again, renting and ownership.
I'd imagine it might be easier to deal with like a single landlord than with a big management company, though, right? I mean, who's driving it? And I'm wondering, is it not? I know you're saying that it's lack of inventory, but you know, can landlords say, you know what, I'm just going to jack it up $1,000? I mean, is it greed or is it desperation?
Well, go ahead, please.
I would say a little bit of both. You know, absent of rent controls, the landlords are at, you know, their will to raise the rent sometimes with or without notice in enough time so that people can prepare or decide to do other things. But where will they go? Because that next landlord is doing the exact same thing. Speaking as it relates to supply and demand, I would agree that's the foundation of how we build our communities across this nation. But when you look here, especially within Miami-Dade proper, the buildings are going up. So I believe the shortage really is the missing middle. We have an abundance of luxury at market rate apartment units that unfortunately go vacant night after night because the people who need them cannot afford to live in them. So the supply and demand, it's really as a matter of what's getting built for the people who need them versus the people who are building them for this new population that's expected to come. So that's where I believe the supply and demand shortage is about. It's about that missing middle piece.
And no, that's a good point. And I know I said earlier that I've seen so many towers built, but then I also noticed the cars that are going into those buildings are Lamborghinis and Mercedes Benzes. I'm just wondering again, with the way the laws are set up in Florida, if the landlord can do pretty much whatever they want, I mean, at what point does it get to the point? Do the renters have any rights? Is, I think, what I really want to get at. Do we have any rights as renters to say, hold on, this is too much?
In terms of contractual rights, absolutely. But in terms of rate setting, none that I'm aware of. And Daniela mentioned rent control, and that's very common in New York City. The issue that we have now is horrific. It's going to be short-lived. I don't think rent controls. I hope we don't go in that direction here. Rent controls in New York City has led to, yes, controlled rent, but the quality of the housing stock, the condition of the units has gone down tremendously. And so you have very poor maintenance at that point in time. This will pass. There is skewness involved in this. In other words, yes, there being more luxury units are being developed than for workforce housing, if you will. And there's a lot of reasons behind that. And it falls, the blame, I believe, falls both to the developers and the local municipalities. The process for permitting in Miami-Dade or anywhere in the Southeast across all of our different municipalities is draconian, non-transparent. Nobody knows how to do it. The small-time developer has just completely left the market because of these uncertainty costs. So I think developers and the municipalities share in the blame for this shortage. And again, it's been 10 years in the making, and there is skewness in it.
The other thing too, Ken, is, and I'm not the economist, you would know, but I thought that if housing was going up, rents usually were going down, but that's not the case.
No, that's not a one-to-one trade-off. We're having a shortage of both. Did a little bit of, I got a different calculation than the Bloomberg, but we had rents going up by almost 17% year over year from September to September. And the cost of home ownership in the same area was going up over 23%. Mm. So both are going up tremendously year over year. And again, it comes back to the shortage.
Amber, I don't know if you had the chance to speak to landlords. I wondered what they had been telling you or just people's experiences with their landlords if, you know, if they got any kind of leeway.
Yeah, I've been able to talk to a few landlords, and a lot of them told me that this is really just a sign of the market, and they really need to, they've been trying to recover certain costs after the past year and a half. They've been facing rising insurance rates, there's maintenance costs, and especially for the private landlords who are renting out homes, they've been facing higher property taxes, and home insurance is a lot more expensive. And when you deal with a private landlord, based on what they told me, they are a little bit more willing to work with their tenants because they have a relationship with them. And for them, they want to keep a good tenant in. And they're more cognizant of the struggles that renters are facing, other besides these bigger apartment complexes.
Mm. We are hearing from so many folks here across South Florida. Another listener texted in, quote, "Fortunately, I can afford an increase, but now that Wall Street's participating in the market, you allegedly are seeing all the liability shifted to renters through clever agreements, abusive charges. Like cats and birds, you have to pay the same as dog fees. That's not apples to apples. I notice there's no representation for renters. And why is that?" Daniela, what kind of help or legal representation is out there for tenants? I kind of touched on that a second ago. Like, what rights do I have, or who can I turn to?
Well, I mean, as we look at the Florida State Statute in Chapter 83, I mean, there's a long list of things that are available for that own the property owner. And there are some things that are available as protections and rights for the tenants. But I would say that we need to further update and expand and cover more renter protections in Chapter 83. Some available resources on the ground, legal resources, they have Hope Fair Housing. Many of the counties and municipalities have the emergency rental assistance programs that are still going on now, as well as available at our state level, the Our Florida, which was able to not only help out with back rent, but also back utilities. So there are still some options that are available. Most of these options are via technology, and many of the people who may need the assistance may not be savvy enough to utilize such as devices to apply. That's
a challenge. A very good point. Yeah. So, I mean, for convenience, so much of what we do now is through our phone or, you know, an app, but not everybody can access that. Again, talking about rising rents here in South Florida, why they're going up so fast, and what is that doing for folks here in the area? Like, when you're looking for a rental, share your story. What's happening right now as you're out there hunting for a rental? Text us 786-677-0767 or email us sundial@WLRNnews.org. We've been hearing from a lot of you. Another one on social media. One of our listeners on Twitter actually said, "Rent goes up every year where I live in Weston, but buying a house is even harder, and I don't see any new single-family homes being built." All right, let's take a break, come back, and continue this conversation. Again, we want to hear your stories. Email us, sundial@WLRNnews.org. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Again, today we're looking at the rising cost of living in South Florida, specifically rent, why rents are going up so fast. We're talking with Amber Randall of the Sun Sentinel, Daniela Pierre as the president of the Miami-Dade branch of the NAACP and a housing advocate, and Ken Johnson is the associate dean of graduate programs at the College of Business at FAU. And again, we want to hear your story. You can text us 786-677-0767. We've been getting a lot of texts coming in, like Jessica in Hollywood. She says, "We've been looking to move to a better apartment. We pay $1,100 per month only because our building isn't to code. The cheapest two-bedroom apartment within Broward County is $1,500 per month. That's a 50% increase. We can't buy because student loans ruined my credit." Another person chimed in and said, "I've been looking for a place to rent. There's no low-income housing for seniors. And if you have a pet, which older people usually do, forget it. I've got a 15-year-old dog and can't even find a room to rent. The room rent now is $800 a month. I only make $2,000 a month. After car payments, insurance, and medical, I can't eat. Renting in West Palm Beach is horrible unless you have money. Ken, one of the things that we see is right now a lot more people are spending anywhere from 40 to 50% of their income on housing. South Florida, again, one of the worst places in the country for this. What's a health in a healthy economy? What percentage of my income should go to housing?
Typically, that ratio should be somewhere between 25 and 33%, with 33% being on the high end in the more populated cities. So when we start hearing numbers at 40% and greater, you're going to get these horrific incidents like you're talking about right now. So there's something that's got to be done. Time will help solve this, but we are definitely at the top of a rent cycle right now.
I mean, if you see those numbers climbing and people are spending 40, 45% or more on housing, how long can you sustain that?
Well, both rent prices and the cost of home ownership, they're sticky because it's hard to change or repurpose a unit. It takes time. I know we don't like to hear that or don't want to hear that, but even without building extra units, we have to repurpose much of our housing stock, and it just takes time. So you get this stickiness in prices. The demand, the supply of housing becomes perfectly inelastic in the short run. So you get these big swings in prices. This will pass with time, but it's not going to be an easy pill to swallow.
You know, I'm wondering, too, you talk about supply, and how in the world are we going to catch up on supply in an area like South Florida where, you know, we've got flooding issues, sea level rise issues. We just had the big conference, the climate conference, and, you know, everybody talks about Miami and South Florida being the canary in the coal mine. This probably isn't a good place to build, and yet we need to build more?
It's very popular to live in Southeast Florida. Something I've been saying for years, we have trouble with sea level rise, but the Dutch have been living below sea level for 300 years. So there's solutions. This is a popular area. It's going to continue to be popular. Again, it comes back to how do we address workforce housing and housing for people that are already here, and we're just in this huge shortage. For workforce housing, I would love to see, and it's not going to happen tomorrow, but I would love to see the next time we're in the bottom of a housing cycle, this is the time when public-private partnerships should be forged out and put into play. We had our chance back in 2012 to do a lot of this when the issue of unaffordable housing completely disappeared in 2012 when we hit the bottom of the housing market because everything was down.
Aren't those controversial, and don't we always run into that issue of you know, NIMBY, not in my backyard. I don't want that stuff here.
To some extent, yes, but not always. But yes, but this property has to be developed. We all need for our teachers and firemen and people that work in restaurants and schools to be able to drive to work in a reasonable period of time. Without that, the quality of services within an area will drop off tremendously, and the popularity of an area will go down tremendously.
All right. So much to grasp here. And maybe I'm trying to stay positive, but, you know, I'm just thinking about the future. If we continue on this, we are hearing from so many folks, so many unbelievable stories. Giselle wrote in and said, you know, it's pricey to live in Coral Gables, but as a single mom, it was always my priority to strive to live in what I consider to be a safe place with access to good schools. I give up every day on many things to live here. We live the simplest of lives to be able to afford our rent. We're conservative on all fronts, such as food, entertainment, and clothing. Amber, you know, one of the things that really blew my mind when I was reading your story is just how people, the things they had to give up just to be able to stay in their neighborhoods. They desperately wanted to stay where they were living. Again, maybe because of the schools or something else about that neighborhood. But tell me about some of the stuff that you found that surprised you about what people are giving up everyday life just to be able to afford to live where they do.
Yeah, I know a lot of people first start out with sacrificing their entertainment budget. So they kind of stop, they stop going out, they stop their leisure activities, they may cut down on their vacation. But as it gets more serious, we see a lot of people dipping into their rainy day funds, into these emergency savings that they've been saving over the past year, year and a half, to be able to afford rent. In the more serious cases, we see people giving up cars. They start taking public transportation. Some people are juggling when they pay bills. They may delay paying one bill because there's just not enough money to go around with these rental increases. And even worse, we see some people who are priced out onto the streets and living in their cars because there's no affordable apartments in our area.
I mean, that's scary when you're seeing people, and we heard from one of the comments earlier that you're deciding what bills to pay because you can't pay them all every month. We're hearing from so many folks, and again, you can always email us your story, your thoughts on this, sundial@wlrnnews.org. We heard from Shannon in Key West. She says, after the 2008 financial crisis, I lost my home that I owned for 10 years. I immediately applied for public affordable housing. 5 years later, right before Hurricane Irma, I was called in to start the application process. This November makes 4 years I've been living in affordable housing. Daniela, I mean, I remember last time I had you on, you know, you have a fascinating story, you know, and a connection to this housing insecurity because you lost your home in 2013. And I just, you know, remind us of what that experience was like and really what it's been like for you to try to bounce back, because that's a lot harder than people will ever admit to.
Absolutely. And you, to believe it or not, I'm still trying to bounce back. You know, I can definitely understand that story just shared about the last caller, because I'm still waiting on my affordable housing to come through. And, you know, ever since I lost my home, I thought it would have been, you know, easier to rent. But I also found out I was priced out. So it was very hard to get into somewhere to rent affordably so that I wouldn't pay over 30% of my income, so that I could save up for a rainy day. It was impossible. And moving forward, while you're trying to find that space and that place to live, you're paying out your money in application fees, $85, $100, which are all non-refundable. So you go to this apartment complex. Yes, we have one unit available. To that one unit, they may take in 20 applications. You're not guaranteed to even live there. So now you just wasted part of that rainy day fund on an application fee that you cannot get back. And if you don't move in there, right around the corner, you have to shell out another $85.
Yeah. And then, you know, as we heard earlier, you got people who will come in and will drop the first 6 months right away. And then they're cutting the line. They're just going to jump right in front of everybody. And yeah, you've lost the application fee. We heard from Maria in Palmetto Bay. She says, my son is still living at home. He can't afford to move out. My daughter's renting and can't find affordable housing for her family. I'm ready for retirement, but I would have to leave South Florida to afford it. It's crazy out there. Brian from Miami Beach says, residents have taken Miami for granted with decent rents for a long time. Tenants that took advantage during COVID are now fueling the crazy rise in rents. Amber, have people been able to take advantage of rental assistance from the federal government during COVID? Has that made a difference in any way?
Yeah, they've definitely been able to get federal assistance, and it has made a difference for the people who do qualify for it. And I think that's the bigger problem, that this issue of rental affordability is so widespread that there are a lot of people out there who don't necessarily qualify for that assistance, but desperately need it because these rental prices are so insane for everyone.
Ken, you know, I think about after the 2008 crisis, a lot of people lost their jobs, their credit tanked, and some of them are still trying to build their lives back up. That's 12 years later. And I'm wondering, with this, after the pandemic's over, and then, you know, whatever happens to the economy next, because we're dealing with inflation, you're going to have a lot of people who lost their jobs, their credit tanked, and they lost their savings. How does the economy handle that?
I think you're going to see unemployment actually continue to go down, but we're still going to get these individual cases where, you know, this is something that's happening, and how do we deal with this? And the big issue at hand then is a societal impact. So at points in time, you have to step in with either local, state, or federal assistance to keep make sure that housing is available, quality housing is available. Until then, markets tend to work, but markets do break down at times. Markets break down at extreme heights and peaks of a market. And that's true for everything from stocks and bonds to housing to the market for shoes. So right now we're going through a particularly rough patch. I don't see it going away for the next several months to a couple of years, because again, it comes back to inventory. But the upside to all of this is I moved into this market circa 2005 as I came to teach at FIU, and I'm now at FAU, and I was shocked by the prices, but I wanted to stay for the opportunity, and it was the right decision for me not to move out of the market, but to tough it out. And I'm glad I did, and I'm glad I live in South Florida, and I don't like these problems, but I would much rather be living here than really anywhere else in the country.
You know, and then just briefly, I wanted to ask, you know, because you said until we get that inventory up, but how long do you think that would take?
To get the units in balance with demand, we're probably looking at 12, 18, 24 months. And that's if we build at a rapid pace. It just depends on the pace we develop. It depends on the cooperation between developers and municipalities. They've got to start to participate, to coordinate.
It's
complicated.
It's also hard because, you know, you could build luxury and, you know, get more bang for the buck. As we finish up here, Daniela, you know, what advice do you have for folks who are facing some of these difficult situations? You were touching on it a moment ago.
You know, just to, you know, follow up with, we have to look at the supply and demand. Is what's getting built supporting the supply or increasing our demand? I drive every day going to like downtown Miami, parts of Brickell, and I see buildings just going up, cranes on top of cranes. And all we can do as the workforce is just watch it go up. We can't afford to live there.
Yeah.
So while we're waiting for this, you know, either 12 to 18 month turnaround, we are calling on developers to build what we need now, and they can do it. If you get all this free acres of land and lots, and you have the facilities to run the water and electricity, why don't you carve out some of that space for workforce housing?
I got to jump in there. Daniela Pierre is the president of the Miami-Dade branch of the NAACP, a housing advocate. We also heard from Amber Randall, reporter for the South Florida Sun Sentinel, and Ken Johnson, again, is the associate dean of graduate programs at the College of Business at Florida Atlantic University. Thank you all so much for the insight and for sharing the stories. And thank you, everyone who participated in today's program. The easiest way to do it is our text club. Just text us 786-677-0767, because we'll also let you know about programs like this so you can participate. And keep the stories coming, because we want to hear what you're going through, and maybe we can discuss solutions for the future. Well, coming up next, seashells are beautiful, sure, but did you know that they end up in your toothpaste and things like Tums? Yeah, they do. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. The humble seashell really isn't so humble at all. It's the basis for so much of life as we know it. Environmental journalist and author Cynthia Barnett recently published a book that'll make you think completely differently about the colorful shells, small shells, big shells, and really all shells. It blew our lead producer Katie Munoz's mind. Katie recently spoke with Cynthia about her new book.
Cynthia, it is so nice to talk with you again. I never actually got to take your environmental journalism class at UF, but I remember you had started writing The Sound of the Sea when you came with a group of us on a reporting trip to Havana, Cuba, and you were telling us about your first few chapters at dinner one night, and that was more than 4 years ago now.
Yeah, that was a wonderful trip, wasn't it? I actually did a little seashell reporting there that didn't end up in the book. I don't know if you remember, I got my cowrie shell reading done. And there's actually an interesting story about Fidel Castro and Queen Conch that we can get to. But yes, that has been a long time ago, but it actually took me much longer. This book took 6 years longer than any of the others.
Oh my gosh, 6 years. Wow. The story of Fidel Castro and the shell. What was that story?
In the CIA files on the John F. Kennedy assassination that were, they've only been trickled out, and some of them only in about the past 10 years. Some of the recent files reveal CIA plots to assassinate Fidel Castro in all kinds of bizarre ways. You've probably heard some of these, like exploding cigar and so on. But one of the assassination proposals that is detailed in these declassified documents would have filled a beautiful queen conch with dynamite and planted it. They backed off that idea, obviously, and it never happened. But yeah, it's just one of the really interesting stories of queen conchs that I found. And they're so important to Native people too, to the people who were Native to the Bahamas and the entire Caribbean before Columbus arrived. And that was one of my favorite chapters, writing about queen conchs.
Where did your initial inspiration to write about how seashells get made come from?
I was invited to the Bailey Matthews National Seashell Museum on Sanibel Island. I was giving a talk there. And after the talk, I went out to dinner with the director, who was telling me about a survey they did of visitors to the museum to find out how much they already knew about seashells. And the survey showed that 90% of visitors, and many of these people were Florida tourists visiting with their children, 90% of the respondents did not know that a seashell was made by a living animal. Many people thought they were rocks or stones. And I was so shocked and kind of disturbed by that. I couldn't sleep that night. I tossed and turned thinking about it and just, you know, the implications for what that means for our, you know, being severed from nature, we and especially children. And I think by the time I fell asleep that night, I knew I would write this book.
I listened to the audiobook version of your book, and I think what struck me the most, my eyes were really open to how significant seashells and mollusks are. You trace them essentially back to the start of life, and they're these huge players in evolution and, you know, how humans and the landscape around us have come to be what we are today. And I've just never thought so deeply about seashells before.
Yeah, so it was amazing. Like, I wanted to set out to write about seashells. Marine mollusks are about 500 million years old. So I thought, okay, I'll start there. But actually, I ended up going back earlier because I wanted to know, so what little creature in the history of the planet made the very first shell? Like, what was that all about? So I actually started nearly a billion years ago with these marine micro fossils that are evidence of the first shelled life. And basically, you know, the tiniest life a billion years ago begins to build shell, like everything we love about them, their spikes and their spines and their glossy bits. It's all about keeping them safe from their enemies. And so they build their shells with minerals from the surrounding seawater. And you can kind of think of these seashells as a fortress. It is a home, but it is also a fortress for keeping out enemies.
And I guess I should clarify too, when we say mollusk, you know, just in case people don't know what to picture, they can look so different, like goo, or some of them have eyes, and you talk about how different they all are. Different mollusks make different shells. What was that process like to learn about them?
The mollusks, writ large, they're the second largest group of animals on Earth after the arthropods that include insects and crabs. So mollusks are all over the world, like from the top of the Himalayas to the deepest trenches in the ocean, more than 50,000 of them that have been named and many more unnamed. And so, you know, that's kind of an impossible number to deal with. So I ended up choosing 12 really iconic seashells from human history. You know, I'm thinking of all of those people who didn't realize this beautiful seashell, maybe the most beloved object in nature, was made by a living animal. So I picked these 12 and built the book around those 12 shells. So they include things like, you know, queen conchs, money cowries, and others that people would really recognize.
You talk about how seashells have been everything from a form of Native American currency of sorts to their limestone, you know, ends up in our toothpaste and our antacids. And they're not just decoration, but they're in so many things. And I'm wondering, how much of this did you know before you started researching your book?
One reason it took me 6 years longer than it should have or might have. Every day was just some astounding story about seashells. And one of the most astounding to me, even now, is the fact that the global oil giant Shell Oil began as a tiny seashell curio shop in the East End of London. And then, you know, there's so much that I wish I would have been able to write more about, like the Japanese Emperor Hirohito was a marine scientist and a huge aficionado of seashells. And he had really beautiful ideas about how science could bring us together. So there were all of those beautiful threads. It really could be the work of a lifetime, and you still wouldn't know all the ways that shells wind into our lives.
I'm speaking with author and environmental journalist at the University of Florida, Cynthia Barnett. She's got a new book out called The Sound of the Sea: Seashells and the Fate of the Oceans. And she'll be speaking at the Miami Book Fair in person this Saturday, November 20th. You can find more about her books and her work on our social media at WLRN Sundial. When you do go into great detail in your book about what shells can tell us and show us about what's going on in the world, how much are seashells the key to better understanding climate change? What are some of the ways they can show us solutions too?
So the oceans have absorbed about 30% of the extra carbon dioxide we've sent into the atmosphere since the start of the Industrial Revolution, and that has made them a third more acidic. And that means that these incredible shell builders, which use carbonate from the surrounding seas, they're being limited in the minerals that they need to build their shells. So that's one part of it. But the other part is that the more acidic water can actually bore into their shells and make them weaker. And then the last part of it is that it also seems to be impacting their behavior, like in some cases, making them clumsy. So it's, you know, they just have so much to say.
Knowing what they're telling us right now, what keeps you optimistic when we look for solutions?
Yeah, so some of the, I think the most important thing to say is that we must reduce carbon emissions. That is sort of the no-brainer that every scientist will tell you. It's not a transition to some terrible sacrifice we have to make. It is a transition to a better world, you know, I think a happier place for us and certainly for the marine life of the oceans.
And in the book, you really take us on a couple of different journeys, because there's this journey about climate change and how we know it's affecting mollusks and seashells. Mm-hmm. But you also take us on this historical journey of the people that made the earliest discoveries about them. And many of them were women that didn't get as much credit at first as the men of their time. And I wanted to ask, you know, you answer the question in your book of a famous woman we all know. She sells seashells by the seashore. And that was a real person. Who was she?
The British fossil expert Mary Anning. Now there's been a major motion picture made about her, so I think she's a little better known. But she is anonymously known to the generations who grew up with the verse that was said to have been written about her. She sells seashells by the seashore. I can't believe I just said that without stumbling. But her real legacies were her extraordinary fossil discoveries that included fossil seashells that really made a difference in our understanding of the world. And in fact, the father of modern geology, Charles Lyell, relied on some of her research where she worked, and she sold fossils at this little fossil shop on the Jurassic coast of England. And Charles Lyell asked her to help him with research on the cliff falls there. And she's not credited in his work. And that is just such a common story, I can't tell you, but it was such a pleasure, you know, in this book to really think about the contributions of women and the contributions of, you know, Native people, even enslaved Africans in the southern United States contributed to Charles Lyell's geology. He would come here to the United States and be looking around the plantations for fossil seashells. And the plantation owners couldn't help him because they hadn't dug the wells or did any of the work. So he would invariably ask to speak to the enslaved land manager, and they knew a lot about the geologic layers of the United States. And these are really important stories in our scientific history that are pretty much completely unknown. So I hope that this starts to give voice to some of those stories as well.
I'm really curious what identity you really most align with, whether that's environmentalist, journalist, professor, or author. What do you most think of yourself?
Thank you for asking me that question, because I have a pet peeve that sometimes people call me an environmentalist, and I have nothing against environmentalists, but I am definitely a journalist with a capital J. That's been the case since I was in fifth grade and I was the editor of my Girl Scout troop newspaper. But I should say, you know well, Marjorie Stoneman Douglas was also a journalist long before she was an environmental activist. She was a journalist for the Miami Herald, and she transitioned to writing books about the environment, including River of Grass. She did not become an environmental activist until age 79. So I suppose there is still time for me to become an activist, but I don't see it right now.
There is still time. That's so funny. It's very true. I won't ask you if you have a favorite shell, because now I know that that's like asking a parent to choose their favorite child. But is there a shell in particular, a specific shell? Maybe it was the first shell that got you interested in this, or maybe it's a shell that kept you going those 6 years writing the book. But is there a shell that's got a particular meaning for you?
Yes, for sure. I love the story of Lightning Welks that I only understood after I did the research for this book. I grew up with Lightning Welks, which are fairly common in Southwest Florida. They look like a conch, except they're more slender, and they have these beautiful, they really do look like lightning strikes running down the side, and they have a really mesmerizing spiral at the top. I realized how important they were to Native people, especially Native Floridians. And so they're very special to me. And I have to say that even before that, like 25 years ago, before I married my husband, we were on a sandbar in Cedar Key, and we found an extraordinary, empty, huge lightning whelk. And it was Christmas time. And we took it home and put it on the top of our Christmas tree, as some people would an angel. And that Lightning Whelk has been at the top of our Christmas tree every year since then for 25 years. And so it's kind of neat to see it come full circle.
That was environmental journalist and author Cynthia Barnett talking with Katie Munoz about her new book. And a reminder that Cynthia is going to be at the Miami Book Fair this weekend talking about seashells. So you can find out more on our social media, WLRN Sundial. Well, that's our program for this Thursday, November 18th. Katie Munoz is our lead producer. Leslie Ovalle is our producer and social media editor. Our engagement editor is Katie Lepre. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. WLRN's interim program director and technical supervisor, Peter J. Mertz. Richard Ives pushing all the buttons this week. Our theme music is by the Miami Afro-Cuban funk band Balo at gopalo.com. You know, earlier in the show, we were talking about the rising rents. We heard from Lisa via email. She said 30% of your income for rent, maybe in Topeka, Kansas. When I can retire, which will be maybe 78 if I'm lucky, I'll be forced to move from Miami-Dade County. Continuing to build luxury homes is not helping the problem, nor is building into the Everglades. Thank you so much for your comment, Lisa. Really appreciate it. Well, coming up next week on our program, we're going to discuss how South Florida's airports are preparing for the holiday season and what are they doing about all those unruly passengers. We are coming up on the Thanksgiving holiday season, of course. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thank you so much for listening. Have a great Friday, a wonderful weekend. The weather might be kind of nasty, but it'll get cool. Stay safe. Be good to each other. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute.
WLRN Public Media.